This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, inviting you to enter the world of arts, cultural affairs, and entertainment with Q's video podcast. Feature interviews with the people and personalities shaping, captivating, and challenging culture. Delivered to your mobile device 3 times a week, visit cbc.ca/Q to subscribe to the Q video podcast and watch what we're doing.
I'm Pauline Dakin. Welcome to Maritime Magazine. Last week, we followed Amy Graves on the very rocky road that she has traveled over the last year or so. In March 2010, her brother Josh died unexpectedly. Just back from Alberta, he made a fatal mistake at a party. He mixed alcohol with a prescription painkiller, Dilaudid.
I don't feel like anyone forced it down his throat, but I really feel like he made an uneducated choice. If he knew that mixing it with alcohol would result in that consequence, I don't think he would have done it. He wasn't an unhappy person. He actually was doing the best he had ever done in his life. He waited out west for a while to get a position here that paid the same as out there. You think that, you know, you're all safe and sound in the Annapolis Valley and you worry about them out in the big city and you think, you know, if anything's going to happen, it's going to be there. He was only back in the Annapolis Valley 3 weeks when he passed away.
Shocked and heartbroken, Amy threw her life plans aside and took on a cause and a blog called Get Prescription Drugs Off the Street. Margot Brunel brought us the story in her documentary, Amy's War on Drugs. Today, she's here to introduce us to two people who know from experience just how hard a battle it is to get off prescription drugs. Hi, Margot. Welcome back.
Hi, Pauline.
Amy's story is just so compelling and her brother's death so terrible. And he, of course, had no history of drug abuse prior to that awful night, right?
Well, none as far as we know. He was the picture of health and had a great future ahead of him, as Amy says, which made it even more tragic for her that he died so young. But it's no less tragic, you know, for people who are battling these demons, their addictions, every day. And even if it hasn't killed them, they're suffering. And Amy sees them as victims, too.
So you're going to introduce us to a couple of people?
Yeah, two former addicts who came to this predicament from very different circumstances. But I found that's not surprising. I've been following the story of prescription drug abuse for a couple of years now, and it seems there's no typical pattern.
So before we hear from those people, give us some background on prescription drug abuse. For the people who maybe haven't been following this story, how has it become such a critical issue?
It's been about 15 years since these very powerful painkillers became readily available through family physicians. Before that, they may have been used in hospitals for cancer treatments. But nowadays, they're quite commonly used for, you know, sore joints or post-op therapy at home as opposed to hospitals. Now, of course, there are many people who will vouch for the relief they provide. But doctors also admit, and you've heard it and I've heard it, that they still have a lot to learn about treating physical pain, about how to measure it, how it manifests itself, how to know how severe it is. And now there's another problem. Some people are using and abusing these medications to fill an emotional need.
And that's even harder to measure and know about than the physical pain.
Of course it is, yeah. It doesn't take long to get hooked either. These painkillers are highly addictive.
So trace for us how the drugs go from the person with a prescription to being on the street.
Okay, so sometimes the pills are stolen from legitimate patients who may have them in their bathroom cupboard or from pharmacies. But also people are getting them through prescriptions, their own prescriptions, and then they're selling extras on the street. Now, Amy Graves, who we met last week and who's been prominent in the news since her brother died in March 2011, she remembers when Dilaudid first appeared in her neighborhood in the Annapolis Valley.
Two older men who were pill dealers in the area, one very close to the school and another one who supplied someone directly across from the high school. So kids would just walk over through the day to this rundown old house. Was just basically a flop house, you know, where anything went.
And the drugs were cheap.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. These people had legal prescriptions. And a lot of times, I don't know in their situations, but they can get them covered by Medicare. And so all the cost of drug dealing and using is covered by the government. Everything's pure profit. And that's when I really started seeing them a lot. one of the kids that really, that I went to school with and grew up with, who was kind of the first person who really got into them bad, he was one of the people who were injecting by the time we left school. He was actually captain of local hockey team, played high school hockey, honor student. He told me the story that he went to go buy some weed from a drug dealer close to the school, one of the ones I was talking about. And he said, oh, I don't have any pot, but try one of these. These will blow your socks off. And so he crushed up a pill and got this young man to snort it. He was 15 at the time, I believe. And he said it was the best feeling ever. And that was just right then he started doing them. And that's when he started bringing them to school. And, you know, his friends found out about it. And then more people found out about it. And but like I said, by the time this one young man left school, he was an IV drug user. And by the time we were out of school a year or two, he actually overdosed at the house across from the school for methadone. He bought diverted methadone, which somebody had to take home for, but he drank it, obviously didn't drink the proper dose, and went into a coma. The ambulance came to the house across from the high school, took him away, and he was in the hospital for at least a week in a coma.
And what kind of shape is he in now? Do you know?
So this is almost, well, 10 years he's been fighting this battle that started with that one pill.
Pauline, that's Amy Graves.
And the reference to the methadone overdose, you know, most people will think of methadone as being the thing that addicts take to keep them off drugs.
Yeah, the good.
The treatment.
The treatment, exactly. And it has been used for decades to do that. But it is a drug, and people do get high off it. At least they get a buzz off it. And it's now being used as a sort of nicotine patch to carry them over while they wait for their next fix. Of course, if it's not monitored, they can take the wrong amount of it, so it's quite easy to overdose on it. And ironically, it's become part of the street trade now, too, just like the painkillers, like hydromorphone, which is the generic name for Dilaudid.
So, Margot, you've met two former addicts who are now in recovery. What are their stories?
Let me first introduce you to Glenn Levy. He's in his 50s now. He was a successful businessman for nearly 30 years, and his chosen field was pharmacy.
Growing up, I never had this sense that I was okay, and I had a prescription for Tylenol 3, and I found if one or two eased my pain, two or three made me feel okay and comfortable in my own skin.
Emotional pain you're talking about?
Yes, yes, yeah. I had the prescription for physical pain, but this certainly addressed my emotional pain.
And when did it escalate?
I remember in 1984, I was a fairly new graduated pharmacist. I was also a manager of my own store in Moncton, and I was in the middle of an armed robbery. And after the whole episode was over, and I was so unsettled, I remember taking a couple Percocet to calm myself and to get that feeling of okay, everything will be fine.
Because you were distraught.
Yes. An armed robbery, someone ironically looking for drugs.
Slippery slope, eh?
Yeah, sad twist. Now, you heard Glenn say even in his 20s, he'd take a Tylenol 3 from time to time to make himself feel better. Of course, I had to ask him if he was drawn to pharmacy work because of his fondness for prescription medication. But he really doesn't think that had anything to do with it. He understands now, after a lot of treatment, that he was self-medicating to try to cover up emotional problems that went way back. He actually did have some physical injuries, too, that gave him chronic pain. And that's why he ended up in hospital 2 years ago. He needed surgery. But he also needed his stash of drugs.
It was the first time I had been without my drugs of choice. I found myself unable to remember the day. My wife would come in to see me, and I couldn't remember what time of day it was, what month it was, what year it was. I was having seizures. I was delirious. I was losing weight. And in all of that, at some point in there, I realized that maybe I was in withdrawal.
Margo, what was he taking that would give him those terrible withdrawal symptoms?
You name it, he was taking it.
Oh, my dear. I was convinced when I went into the hospital that, I was just using more often than I should and more milligrams than I should of any of the drugs. I honestly, and I hate to say this as a pharmacist who, details are very important. I have no idea how much or how often I was using. All I can tell you was a lot and often, very often. Unprescribed benzodiazepines, I was taking hydromorphone, Dilaudid, morphine, Percocet, Tylenol 3, and I'm sure I missed some in there.
Wow, that's quite a list, Margo. How did he get his hands on those drugs? I mean, he was a pharmacist, but how did he cover up that he was taking them?
Well, he didn't want to say, actually, because he doesn't want others to use the same tactic. Mm. He says he wasn't buying them on the street, and he wasn't stealing them off the pharmacy shelf. So he didn't feel like a criminal. But he also didn't realize how badly he was hooked.
I was a drug addict, and it was as much a shock to me as it was to my family doctor, my wife, my children, because I always imagined a drug addict as someone in a dark alley with a spoon and needle and a lighter. That's the thing. I could never imagine myself using street drugs because the quality of the prescription drugs is verified. And we know that we're not getting chemicals that were mixed up in someone's garage in these. These are pure. They're not diluted in any way. They're not tampered with. They're pure and effective and deadly.
Glenn Levy went through horrendous withdrawal and then months and months of treatment. 30 days detoxifying in a hospital. Then to Crosby House, it's a private facility in the Annapolis Valley. He did two back-to-back treatments there that lasted about 50 days. And then his therapist realized that Glenn was also dealing with post-traumatic stress. So they sent him to Homewood Health Center in Ontario. It's a facility that deals particularly with PTSD.
And why post-traumatic stress?
Well, as I've said, Glenn was a professional, a devoted husband and a father. He was doing well in life. He was also a volunteer firefighter in and around Parsborough in 2001. Pauline, on the morning of September 11th, when the Twin Towers fell, he and six other volunteer firefighters from the area jumped in a truck and drove down to help with the rescue. I remember doing stories about them. It was, you know, such a heroic act.
And I remember those stories. So he was part of all of that.
Yeah, but the emotional scars from that experience never healed until Glenn found himself in treatment for drug addiction many years later. It was a long haul. Sometimes he felt suicidal, but he also realized he wasn't alone.
I don't think people realize that addicts are often right beside them. They can be someone sitting next to you on a bus. They can be a brother, a father, a grandfather, a grandmother, a sister, a mother. Drug addiction is very prevalent. And coming back to Parsborough was a real challenge. I realized as I was getting ready to come home that I had lost many things. I'd lost a loving relationship with my wife. I had lost the respect of my children, a relationship that I haven't been able to repair as yet. I lost my job, my career. I've had to file for bankruptcy, and I've had to answer for a number of things on a legal issue, and had several interviews with the RCMP. But as I say, there's been no criminal charges from anything I've done.
And you're still in treatment every 2 weeks here in Dartmouth.
That's correct. I see my addiction specialist here in Dartmouth, and I see a psychologist to go through some of my life issues.
So, Pauline, you can see how devastating this has all been for Glenn.
Completely. And it's remarkable how willing he is to speak honestly about all of this.
I know. He has a unique perspective, of course. As a pharmacist, he knew everything about the risks, except how they applied to him. And he now believes that people in the health professions are just as vulnerable to drug addiction as the rest of the population. He's seen it with his own eyes, actually. Glenn still attends recovery sessions in what are called caduceus groups. A caduceus, as you probably know, is a common symbol for the medical profession. We've all seen it, the two snakes wrapped around a winged staff. He hasn't found such a recovery group in Nova Scotia, but he attends one regularly in Moncton and first went to one while in Ontario.
Well, let's just say in the caduceus group that I was in Guelph, there were over 250 members to that group, and at any one meeting there would be anesthesiologist, OB, gyn, family practitioner, emergency specialist, dentist, veterinarians, pharmacists, and of course lots of nurses. Nurses often made up half the room, of course, because they are such a large number. And the majority of the problem was prescription drugs, and in every imaginable way, swallowed, snorted, inhaled, smoked, injected. Everything was present there, and it was quite humbling to see the impact on the profession.
Pauline, once again, that's former pharmacist, recovering addict Glenn Levy.
You are listening to Maritime Magazine on CBC Radio 1. I'm Pauline Dakin, and joining me this morning is Margot Brunel. We're talking about the issue of prescription drug abuse. And Margot, you said we were going to meet two people. Who's the second?
Yeah. The other recovering addict I met recently relied mostly on drugs prescribed by her own family doctor for years. Her name is Kristen Dowling.
And so how did she get hooked?
In her case, she started doing hard drugs as a teenager, crack cocaine, crystal meth, and so on. But in her mid-20s, she added Dilaudid and hydromorphone to that list and soon realized it was easier and cheaper to feed her habit with pharmaceutical drugs. At her worst, she says she was using 120 milligrams a day.
Wow.
That's a massive amount. Mm-hmm. A normal starting dose for severe pain is 16 milligrams a day.
6 years I was doing them for. So from like 24 to 29.
What did you look like?
I was like 100 pounds. I was very skinny. Sick.
And you were a mother.
Yes, I was a mother, 5 kids. And I found it very hard to watch my children when I didn't have these pills. It was hard to move. It was hard to get out of bed. You were sick all the time. Like, couldn't do nothing.
Where were you getting them?
The doctor, and buying them off the street.
One particular doctor?
Yes.
Your GP?
Yeah.
How do you think it went so long without him recognizing that you were addicted and it was affecting your health?
I don't have the answer for that. I don't know. Maybe he did know, but I myself don't know how it goes for so long. Everybody knew.
Pauline, that's Kristen Dowling.
Margot, how did she pay for all of that medication?
She had it all figured out.
Selling her own scripts. We'd sell ours to buy more.
Walk me through it.
We'd go get our script. We'd do whatever we were doing. When somebody else had a prescription, we'd sell ours, we'd buy theirs. Like, we always had money. We always had money to buy other people's scripts, whether it came from our prescription or whether it came from other money that we were getting. We always had money to buy scripts.
A lot of money?
Yeah.
And your prescriptions were paid for by the government?
Yeah, they were.
Because you were on social assistance at the same time?
Yes, that's right.
That's a lucrative business then, yeah. Isn't it?
Yep.
Is that how a lot of people are making a living?
A lot of people, yes, they were. They probably still are.
Wow.
Kristen admits she knew how to work the system, as do many other people who are addicted. Sometimes when she wanted more pills, she'd tell her doctor she'd lost her medication. He'd write her another prescription. Eventually, he cut her off, and that's when she robbed a pharmacy.
And what happened?
Well, one day she was desperate. She walked into a pharmacy, told them it was a robbery, and told them to fill a plastic bag full of pills. 5 hours later, she was arrested. Soon convicted. She served 10 months of a 3-year sentence at the Federal Nova Institute in Truro.
And she's clean now?
After going through the same horrific withdrawal as Glenn Levy. In fact, it's a miracle she's alive after using that many drugs for 5 years. While Kristen was on trial, they had to rush her to hospital twice because she was so sick. But she's a determined young woman. She refused methadone treatment because it's another drug she didn't want to get hooked and is trying to get her life back on track. She wants to train as an addictions counselor.
If I can do what anybody can do, you have to want to change. And just, I hope that my story touches other young mothers or even young fathers who can get caught up and end up where I did. This is my first time clean in 15 years.
And you feel you've turned a corner now?
Yes, I have. Yeah. I feel great. I'm healthy. I'm happy. I got weight on. Like, I'm seeing my kids. I can function without pills.
So is Kristen's family doctor still practicing?
Yes, he is. Kristen didn't want to name him, but I asked if she'd thought of launching a formal complaint with the College of Physicians and Surgeons. She has considered it, but she says she doesn't have it in her right now. She's gone through a lot in a short time.
Mm-hmm, she really has. So you mentioned the Nova Scotia College of Physicians and Surgeons. What did they say about all of this?
Well, Dr. Gus Grant is the new head of the college, and we've interviewed him on Information Morning here in Halifax. He says that, of course, the college is concerned about this issue. They recently adopted a set of clinical guidelines surrounding how certain drugs, opiates for chronic non-malignant pain, are prescribed. And anyone who believes a doctor is overprescribing can launch a complaint with the college and they will investigate. My question was this: if there appears to be a problem in a certain clinic and we have the prescription monitoring program, which is supposed to keep track of who's getting which drugs where, why can't the college identify a problem and take care of it?
The prescription monitoring program, and I should say I'm on the board of this, that does a fantastic job at what it is supposed to do, but I'm afraid it is overburdened by unrealistic expectations. The job of the prescription monitoring program is to monitor the patterns of prescribing habits and to identify outlying prescribing habits. When an outlying prescribing habit has been identified, the prescription monitoring program can inquire with the physician as to see if there are genuine clinical reasons for this pattern. In the event the prescription monitoring program is not satisfied, it's available for the prescription monitoring program to file a complaint with the college, and they have. The fact of a complaint, the fact that there is an investigation ongoing, is not something we disclose publicly. Once there's been a finding from a complaint that represents a disciplinary matter, it's at that point in time that it's disclosed to the public. A sad truth is this: although the Valley has been touched by tragedy, prescribing habits in the Valley are not significantly different than prescribing habits elsewhere in the province.
Pauline, that's Dr. Gus Grant, the head of the Nova Scotia College of Physicians and Surgeons, and that was from an interview I did with him in February.
So, Margot, as he said, and as we heard in the documentary last week, the prescription monitoring program in Nova Scotia is still a work in progress, but we are talking about the drug trade here, and that's a criminal matter. What do you hear from police?
Well, the police do think the PMP, as it's called, is having some effect. Or maybe it's all the awareness that's been created from stories like Amy's. Whatever it is, the number of prescriptions on the street does seem to be slowing, and the drug trade is not as prolific as it was at its peak. What the police still worry about, though, is that there's always another drug on the horizon. People who make a living from trafficking will always find something to sell. You remember Mark Mander from last week's documentary. He's the chief of the Kentville Police, and he's also the head of the province's Chiefs of Police Association. He's hoping the awareness that Amy Graves and people like her have created will finally lead to a more comprehensive and vigilant approach by health, justice, and education officials.
Well, what I see that was missing in, and certainly the government has said that they're going to put in the surveillance system, is a coordinated effort between health, justice, and the ME.
The medical examiner.
The medical examiner. What we were seeing is that what the police were reporting to the medical examiner wasn't necessarily being shared with health. And what was happening in the emerge rooms in relation to overdoses wasn't being shared with the police or the medical examiner. So there was no coordination of what was happening. So I see the benefit of that is that we'll be able to see the new things that are going to happen on the horizon. My biggest fear is that we have an incident like they had out in Calgary where there was ecstasy that was laced and it killed a bunch of young people, and we would never see that. In our current system, we would never see that.
Because you're all working as separate entities.
We're working in separate entities, and there's no mandatory testing of blood when people come in for certain types of drugs, so we would just simply miss those things.
That's Kentville Police Chief Mark Mander. So he believes we are making progress, though he'd like to see more. Now, Pauline, you'll remember that I mentioned earlier in our chat that even Amy Graves thinks of the addicts in her community as victims, not perpetrators of the prescription drug problem.
Right, yeah.
Well, Kristen Dowling got in touch with Amy, even while she was in prison, and they've since become friends. Kristen has even spoken at some of the public meetings that Amy organizes.
I don't condone anything she did, and I don't think she does either. She admits she should have went to jail. Not once did she say I shouldn't have been punished for what I did. But if I can tell somebody has a problem, I can see that they're 90 pounds soaking wet and, you know, going in constantly for early refills. I don't understand how her doctor didn't see that.
Do you like her?
I do. I mean, we've come close. I hear the horror stories around town. I really think that person they talk about is the addicted Kristen. I don't know any addicts that are kind, generous, when they're that deep into addiction, you know, like she was. She was in deep. So I'm proud of her for actually speaking out and speaking up.
And Pauline, Glenn Levy too, the pharmacist who's been deeply humbled by his experience, he feels it's important to speak out too. As for Amy Graves, I don't think she'll be giving up her crusade anytime soon.
No, she's very dedicated to it. Margot, thank you so much for bringing us these stories.
You're welcome.
The CBC's Margot Brunel in Halifax. Well, I'm Pauline Dakin, and this is our last show of the season. I just want to say thank you to Margot and all the great reporters and freelancers who've brought us their stories this year. And I want to just remind you that if you want to hear some of them again, you can always hear them on our website. That is cbc.ca/maritimemagazine. Now, usually during the summer, we play some of our favorite documentaries again, but this year we're doing something just a little bit different. Our colleagues in Sydney have produced a series of feature interviews with people who are considered to be leaders in their fields. In fact, that's what the series is called. So over the next 8 weeks or so, we'll be playing those interviews here on Maritime Magazine in the summer. And we begin next week with the celebrated author, Alistair MacLeod. I hope you'll come back for that. And in the meantime, for producer Christina Harnett and me, have a wonderful summer and happy Father's Day to all the fabulous dads out there.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.